I wonder how many of us wake up every day and wonder how much longer we're going to be able to live where we do. I'm thinking not too many of us, but there are quite a few people in our country who do just that. For the most part, they are tribal people, Native Americans, who live in coastal areas and face the threat of rising sea levels every single day. What are their choices? Where can they relocate? Are they the first official group in the United States to be called climate refugees? Let's find out. Hello, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Advocacy. And I am thrilled to have as my guest a brilliant, powerful, and what I would call a content area expert on Indian tribes and tribal land ownership. Her name is Mary Guss. She is an attorney by trade, a fellow Rotarian, and she definitely knows quite a bit about Indigenous people and about rising sea levels, having spent 3 decades in Ketchikan, Alaska, both as a Superior Court judge and as a solo practitioner. She was the guest speaker at our Rotary Club several months ago, and as hard as it was for me to listen to what she had to say, I knew I had to interview her because these are the kinds of stories that need telling. Trust me when I say you'll want to stay with us and not miss a minute of what Mary has to say about her experience and about what is happening to the people who have been living here in our country since time began. Mary, thanks so much for being here. And I mean it. It does. I'm not sure I want to hear it all again, but it has to be heard again. And here's how I'd like this to go down. When I heard you speak at Rotary, I went through the entire range of emotions from anger to disbelief to sadness to outrage and then just a little bit of joy, I think. And that was because of what you're doing. I really was moved beyond words and, of course, had lots of tears at times. So I got in my car and I called our show producer, Kelly King, and said, Kel, we have to have Mary Guss on the Impact Earth Show to talk about advocacy and social justice. I kept asking myself, and I keep asking myself, can this really still be happening? We stole their land. We put them out of sight and out of mind in many cases. And we still pretty much have all the power when it comes to American Indian nations. Let's be honest. How can this be? So what I really want you to do is take it away, Mary. Give us some context to set the stage. Tell us some of the tribes that are facing the reality of climate change front and center. And then if you possibly can, give us a little shred of hope at the end or maybe the call to action. And I promise to ask some questions in between. What's happening? How can it still be happening? Mm-hmm. Take it away, Mary.
All right. First, thank you for that lovely introduction. And I do need to correct one thing. I was not a Superior Court judge. I was a federal magistrate judge. So just to keep the record straight.
Man, I was giving you a big, I don't know, was that a promotion or something?
You did give me a promotion,
but...
yes. Yeah. And perhaps I could have gotten a raise, but...
Yeah. And I'm glad that you corrected it so that you don't get sued and I don't get sued. So yeah. Thank
so
you
people
for that.
Don't call me and say, why were you saying
why
you were
you
a Superior Court
that?
Judge?
Yeah. Thanks, Mary.
So let me say, first of all, a little bit about how I developed the interest in this particular subject. In 2008, I went back to school to get an advanced law degree in Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy at the University of Arizona. And in the course of one of my classes, I wrote a paper on using litigation to deal with climate change and focused on 2 particular tribes in the U.S. Over time, the litigation was less interesting to me than the stories of what was happening to people on the ground and the ways that they were trying to deal with what they were facing and the partners that they hooked up with to help them deal with what they were facing. And I have spoken a couple of times about these issues and about the 2 particular tribes that I focus on because of the interest that grew out of that. I'm probably not the best person in the world to speak about this, but I have learned a great deal, and I care about the stories a great deal, so I'm delighted to be able to talk about it. To set a little context, let me talk about Indian tribes in the United States. And first, let me say that Indian is not considered a derogatory term by the vast majority of people living in reservations, and that Native American is also used, but you will find Indian slightly more often. So some people think there's a certain political correctness to saying Native American. Not so. So I will probably say Indian tribes throughout, and I will let you know that there are 577, plus or minus, federally recognized Indian tribes in the United States. And to be a federally recognized Indian tribe affects the relationship that the tribe has with the federal government. So it's a sovereign-to-sovereign relationship in which the tribe controls certain things on the reservation and is able to access certain federal programs because of their status as a federally recognized tribe. There are over 300 Indian reservations in the United States. And a reservation is typically an area of land reserved under a treaty or other agreement with the federal government for the use of the tribe.
Do you think most people are shocked by those numbers? Because I was. Like, I think that people know about, oh, there's the Navajo Reservation, and there's the Hopi Reservation, and there's the Tohono O'odham. So it's very kind of geographically specific if you live in an area, but that, I had no idea. So they're obviously from very little to very big.
They are indeed. The smallest reservation is a reservation in California that has 1 1/3 acres. There are some very,
very
tiny ones. The largest one is Navajo, which we know about being here in Arizona, and has 16 million acres.
Okay.
There are different structures for the reservations. Some of the California ones are centered around the old missions that the Spanish established. Some of the villages in Alaska are considered reservations or federally recognized tribes. So they take different forms, but they constitute over 56 million acres of land in the United States. And Arizona, 26% of the land base in Arizona is federal Indian reservations. We have the first largest, the Navajo, and the second largest, Tohono reservations in this state.
And so, it's really, that's a lot of land.
It is
so a lot. So it's
of
very
land.
Visible here, and there's San Carlos. I mean, if you live in Arizona, which is a really big state to begin with, you're more aware of it. But still, that 500-something number is like, whoa, I had no idea.
Right. Sometimes the reservation that a tribe is located on is part of its original land base. Often it's not. There are a number of reservations that were created when tribes were removed by force from their original homelands. And everyone has heard about the Trail of Tears, where the Cherokee were moved from the east to land in Oklahoma. So reservations may or may not be where tribes originally resided. Using that for context, I have picked two tribes that I talk about generally when I talk about rising sea levels and issues that the tribes are facing because of that. And I need to say a couple of things. This is not a new issue. We're speaking about it in 2019, but one of the tribes that I will talk about first voted in the very early 1990s to relocate its community because of the rising sea
it's
levels.
Like 30 years.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and it's been up and down and side to side and backwards and forwards, and progress is being made, but it's not linear progress, sadly. And in addition to rising sea levels, there are other issues that tribes are facing that mean that they need to relocate. And it includes things like sea ice forming in the Arctic late in the year, sea ice not forming nearly as thickly as it once did, consequently, communities being subject to storms, floods, in Alaska, melting permafrost is a huge issue. So I talk about rising sea levels, but there are other factors that are involved in these things. And as I say, it is definitely not a new issue. So why did I pick the two tribes that I picked? And let me explain to you what tribes they are. The first is the community of Kivalina, which is located in Arctic Alaska. It's about 83 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And as I say, it's been involved since the early 90s with solving the problem for its community and perhaps finding a place to relocate. Kivalina is not the only village that's facing that issue. In a 2003 GAO report, it was noted that 184 of the 213 villages in Alaska were feeling the effects of erosion and flooding. And there were discussions commenced about moving, relocating, doing whatever needed to be done to save those communities.
Can I just interrupt for a minute?
Anytime.
Because I just want to ask some questions, and I'll forget if I wait to the end. First of all, I just want to comment, and you can certainly respond to this, but when you talk about land and Native Americans or Indians, it's not the way that we talk about land. We just get up and move. We just move. First of all, we're not on a reservation. Mm-hmm. There's that whole conversation. We have the freedom to go wherever we want. Our tribes are all broken up, which still bothers me because I want to live closer to my tribe that is now in, a lot of them are in Taos. But any Native American I know is aware of and very consciously committed to the sacredness of the land. They get it, that the land gives us life, that the land gives us food, that, you know, the beat goes on. So for them, it's a much, it's not like, well, let's just get this piece of land in Upper Connecticut and that'll be good. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of moving parts from their cultural perspective. Is that?
That's one aspect of it. The land is incredibly important. Another aspect of it, I would say, is that community is incredibly important. So six families from a total of 100 families leaving the community and going somewhere else would be heartbreaking the people that are involved. And in the community of Kivalina, there at this time are a total of just over 450 residents.
That have lived there forever.
Well, they haven't lived there forever, and there's a story to that, too, which I will get to, yes. But it has been their home since the very early 1900s, and there are economic and lifestyle benefits that accrue to them from being there, plus the community benefit. So, yeah, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. The other community I talk about is Île de Jean-Charles, which is located in Louisiana, about 90 miles south of New Orleans. Louisiana experiences more coastal wetland loss than all other contiguous states combined. There are those who say that Louisiana is the fastest disappearing landmass on Earth, and that there has been an estimated loss of over 2,000 square miles of land between 1932 and 2016. So those are pretty dramatic examples of what's happening, and those are the two communities that I focus on. Kivalina is on a barrier island in the Arctic. On one side is a saltwater lagoon, and on the other side is the Chukchi Sea, the open ocean. At its widest, the barrier island is a quarter mile wide. At its maximum, it's 10 feet above sea level. It has been accessible only by boat and plane. There is a road in process of being built to the mainland on the saltwater lagoon side because there have been some big scares about evacuating during storms and that sort of thing. Boats and planes have been the traditional way to get off the island, and in a big storm, neither of those is functional, and it can be very scary. Kivalina started as a seasonal camp, a stopping-off place for travelers, a hunting and fishing spot. It was used for that purpose. And the first recorded contact with European was with Russian sailors who mistook the seasonal camp for a permanent settlement in the mid-1800s. In the late 1800s, the United States got the bright idea that this would be a good area for reindeer husbandry, so they delivered reindeer for the island and funded training of locals, hoping that they would learn to be reindeer farmers. That only lasted about 6 years. Did not work out. And the current location of the permanent settlement of Kivalina began in 1905 when the BIA built a school on the southern tip of the island. People migrated there so that their kids could attend school and didn't have to go off to boarding school, and so that the families could be around where the children were attending school. The first post office in Kivalina was until 1940. First airstrip was 1960, and it was incorporated as a city in 1969. Historically, the average July high has been 57 degrees, the average January low, minus 15. So, obviously, consequently, sea ice on the Chukchi appeared early in the season, was extremely thick, and lasted a long time. That's no longer the case. So the biggest issue with that is that on the ocean side, the barrier island is no longer protected from the big storms that blow in from the sea with wind and waves in the wintertime. Historically, Kivalina has had a subsistence economy. So hunting, fishing, gathering. They're one of the very last communities to hunt bowhead whales in the Arctic, but with the thinning of the sea ice, taking the boats out onto the ice to search out bowheads has become problematical. They also hunted walrus, seal, caribou, gathered berries, edible plants, birds. But again, there was a need to go out on the sea ice for some of the hunting, and that has obviously become a serious problem. The largest employers in the community at this point are the school district, and there's a native store that sells to the community. So those are the two largest employers. Artisans carve ivory, make jewelry from whalebone and caribou hooves. So it's a tied to the land subsistence sort of economy that exists in Kivalina.
And the thing that I think we should point out is that the ivory is from tusks of something they have eaten or used every part of. They're not out there getting the ivory tusks and cutting them off like they are with the elephants and the rhinoceroses. It's very different and very sacred. Is that accurate?
That's part of it. And sometimes the tusks are found discarded. There is a carving of fossilized ivory, tusks that have been found.
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, the hunting is not happening just for tusks. If walrus is taken, it's for multiple purposes. Yeah. So, the need to remain, or the hope to remain on Kivalina, caused federal, state, local government agencies to get involved to see about erosion control projects that could be put around the community to save them from having to relocate. And between 1992 and 2007, 9 erosion control projects were completed. Millions of dollars were spent. The island continued to erode.
Imagine that. I mean, yeah. I don't want to be sarcastic, but yeah. So how did that work?
Exactly.
How did that turn out for them?
My favorite story about that is that in September of 2006, federal government officials arrived on the island to celebrate the completion of a seawall that had cost multiple millions of dollars. But before the celebration commenced, a storm damaged 160 of the 1,800 feet of seawall, and the celebrations were summarily canceled.
It's not funny, but at some point, you just kind of have to laugh.
You're
trying to, like, basically take on Mother Nature and the advancement of what's happening.
How's
that working for you?
Exactly.
And the other thing I want to add is that I always say this, and it sounds like it's, you know, it's so obvious as the nose on my face, as they say, but when it comes to these kind of populations, it's hard to get your head around that most of them don't have what I would call a J-O-B. They live off the land. They have to find their food or they don't eat. They have to, it's all of it. It's not like going down to Circle K or going to Merrill Lynch or going to your engineering firm and I have to relocate. This is, they live from the land, which is rapidly, even more rapidly disappearing. Did I say rapidly?
Because it's, I think you did.
This was not a great summer for ice melt reporting.
Right. Yes. That's sadly accurate. Yes. So as I think I said before, the community first voted to relocate in 1992. But that carries with it its own set of issues and concerns. Where do you find a place that's suitable? Where do you find the money to move? Where do you find a place that's not going to have similar problems? What government agency do you work with to make this happen? So
it's really complicated.
It is.
And when I heard
you
speak, there's a lot of moving parts.
Right.
And it's, I'm just glad it's not mine to try to solve. Because just hearing it, it's really overwhelming to hear all of the pieces, the cultural pieces, the reality of climate change, where they live, what they do.
Right.
It's not just planning a move.
No, and it's taking longer than I think anybody thought it would take, and it's costing more millions of dollars than I think anyone thought it would take, and that's a huge issue, is the sources for the funding. And sometimes the tribes are out talking to foundations, talking to private sources of money to come up with what it's going to take to get them relocated and settled into housing with all the amenities in a new location. When the 2003 GAO office report was written, it contained four communities that were most important to relocate soon. Kivalina was one of those. The other three were Shishmaref, Koyukuk, and Nutuk. And one of the little rays of sunshine in all of this is that relocation has begun for Nutuk.
Really?
It has begun, yes.
That is good news, everybody. Yes, we should ring the bell here. Here's a little bit of joy.
That's right. One of the main problems in Nutuk was melting permafrost and sinking houses, along with erosion along the river, that sort of thing. So a location about 9 miles away that overlooks the river, but overlooks the river from a place of a solid rock foundation, was found this fall and winter, 2019 fall and winter. 21 households are making the move to the new place.
Wow.
With 137 people. The estimate is that the community will have completely moved in about 4 years. So the way these things go, probably double that,
but there's forward motion.
It has begun. And some infrastructure is in process and will be completed for the new community as well. So that has started.
Yay, I feel like I should ring a bell because there is forward motion.
Right.
It's so complicated. Okay.
As far as I know from my research, that's the only community where the full relocation process has begun in that manner. The next community that I'll talk about has begun a little bit, but it's been a little bit more haphazard. This is the one where there's been some organized work and it's moving forward.
Something substantive to actually report, and that's good.
Yeah,
that's really
exactly,
good for them, and it's not moving to more ice that's going to melt either.
No.
I'm glad you included
that's
that.
A huge issue, yes. Like, that's a huge issue.
How far
issue.
North do you have to go?
exactly, yes. For Kivalina, a place has not been selected yet. Nothing has really substantively begun, and they are facing a number of reports say that by 2026, the community is not going to be viable anymore where it is. So to get the whole community relocated as a community, things are going to need to happen relatively quickly. And maybe they'll take some lessons from what's happening with Nutuk. That would be wonderful. So the other community that I talk about, Île de Jean-Charles, is on an island that originally was 5 miles wide and was filled with beautiful, lush cypress groves and cow pastures, again, about 75 miles south of New Orleans. Currently, there's barely a half a square mile of that island that remains above water. Over 90% of the community's land mass has washed away, and the community has gone from 250 houses down to about 25 now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really dramatic.
It is.
Yep.
And if you see pictures, and there have been a number of articles written about this community, a number of videos produced, amazing newspaper stories. So you have lots of opportunities to see the pictures. It's very dramatic what's happened there. The tribal members in this community are descendants of the Biloxi, Chitimacha, and Choctaw, who came to the island to escape the involuntary relocation that was happening during the removal era. There were, when it was full to capacity, about 400 residents. Currently, about 60 remain, and some of those are taking the position that no matter what, they are not leaving. I guess time will tell.
Because they might have to live on a houseboat.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
It's not funny, but it's true. It's like not leaving, living on what?
Right.
And as you and I know, it's not getting better. And that's not a political statement. It's a measure.
Right.
It's a scientific measure.
Oh, yeah. And it's a thing that anybody can see with their own eyes.
Exactly.
Just looking at the pictures, it's quite dramatic. It also, well, it has only one road into the island. During storms, that road kind of disappears. I've seen pictures of people who know the road driving it, even though the pavement is slightly underwater because they know where the road is. But that's a problem for them as well when they can't come in and out that way or bring in necessities that way or that sort of thing.
And like one hurricane.
Right.
One tornado,
well,
one could wipe them out.
It has been in the path of some of the severe ones lately, including Katrina, and
that
accelerated what they're experiencing, of course. Yeah. Ile de Jean Charles was also a subsistence economy. There was cattle raising, farming, hunting and fishing, being on the coast. Now, with very little land, the community can no longer grow any produce, can't grow herbs for traditional medicines that they've used, can't graze cattle anymore because there's nothing to graze them on. So this tribe has been planning resettlement since 2000. And in 2016, the tribe received $48 million from HUD to relocate. HUD had established something called the National Disaster Resilience Fund, which was sort of a competition. You had to apply for funds from that program, apply for the grant. And Ile de Jean Charles did and was successful and did receive the $48 million. So the funds are to be used in part to purchase land in a new location. And again, there is a concern about will the new location not experience the same problems that happened at the original location? A lot of the land loss in Louisiana is due to canals dug for access to oil and gas production, that sort of thing. So it's not the same situation as at Kivalina, but it is a rising sea level and a loss of land, very clearly.
And what I want to ask, and if you're going to get to this, just stay in the flow, but it's not just simple... they can't find the land. There are so many moving parts and obstacles where to find the land. Tribal members not all agreeing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a part of it. It's like there's not a blame game here per se.
Mm-hmm.
There is the blame game that we did it in the first place,
right.
which we cannot turn back time. But in attempts to try to right the wrong or move forward, there are no simple solutions.
No, and the digger you deep... The deeper
you
dig,
right,
the more you see that there are complex problems and that it's not just one thing that needs to be solved. It's everything that relates to
right.
the one thing.
And it's
thing.
Not obstructionism at all.
Right.
It's challenges.
Right. And unexpected things pop up, like well into the process, tribal members became aware that they were expected to give up their claims to land in the original location if they moved to the new location. And many of them totally disagreed with that.
Said why?
Yeah, exactly.
What are you talking about?
Exactly. And there's a concern that the spot that has been picked has road access and is on the mainland. And there's a concern that it won't be reserved just for the 400 or so members of the Île de Jean-Charles community that need to move, that it will be open for other tribes or potentially even non-tribal members to move there. And that was not the goal that they were aiming for. So there is concern about that. There is rumbling about rejecting the money now, about not making the move to the new location because of some of those concerns. There are things being written about this community all the time, right up until the present. As I said, there are a number of videos out about what they're experiencing. Let me see if I can find some of those for you. There's a documentary called Can't Stop the Water, which is at www.can'tstopthewater.com. Very much worth watching. Last Stand on the Island, which is available on Vimeo. MSNBC has a documentary called The Vanishing Island. And just yesterday, I bumped into a video called Lowland Kids, which is about the last teenagers on the island among the people who are still there and what their experiences are and what their hopes for the future, that sort of thing. So,
and I have to always say that all these links will be shared on the show page because a lot of people listen when they're driving or exercising and can't remember to write it down. So we put the links on the page of the podcast once it's released on November 19th, I believe. So you don't have to get your pens out, people. We'll
wonderful.
Get it. We'll do the work for you.
And we'll make sure we get it right.
And so. We get thanked for that.
Yes.
Yeah. Like you make it easy because I clicked on it.
Yeah. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Yes. Some of the articles that were written early on after Île de Jean-Charles received the grant called them the first climate refugees. I think given what's happening in Alaska, perhaps they are not. But, you know, who wants that designation anyway? So,
and when you take it to a deeper level, which I did when you were talking at Rotary, like I know enough to be dangerous about the Inuit and have heard people speak and had a tribal leader on the show probably now at least a year ago. And this is what is so hard for me to get my head around, but it is the reality of our present and our future. Those people make their living from what they catch. Whether it's through hunting or fishing, it's how they feed their families. It is their industry. It is their livelihood. And eventually, we might not even have any caribou. I mean, let's be honest. There are things that have worked for them for, I don't know how many years, thousands of years, hundreds of years, who knows. And what they are born to do, what's in their culture, what their skills are, is just that. And their very supplies could be disappearing. So it's a very tragic reality to me that with climate change, there will be the ends of lots of things, not just species of plants and animals, but human beings. The tribes will disappear and, you know, they will be carried down in the, you know, in the lineage, but not in the tribes as we know them today.
Right. And not just disappearing some of the animals that they have traditionally hunted, but potentially moving to different locations, which creates the same sort of problem for them. If the caribou are not migrating where the caribou have traditionally migrated, how far do you have to go to hunt them?
Right. Like how far north do we have
viable?
To go?
Viable?
Yes.
Can that happen? If the walrus start disappearing or they haul out at remote, inaccessible islands, that makes a challenge for hunting them.
And they're dying because they're disappearing because they go out to hunt for the walrus and the ice, which has always been absolutely able to hold them, is so thin that they fall in.
Well, there's some of that, I'm sure, and there's always the risk, even when the ice is solid, that's a dangerous kind of hunting. But yeah, more concern to me is that they just won't even be able to try it. They won't be able to go out. Yeah. They won't be able to do
what they do.
Those things that bring the community together during the hunt, bring the community together for celebration afterward, all those sorts of things, it just won't be able to happen anymore. And another complexity is, what do you substitute for that if you're not doing that? Yeah.
Yeah, tell me. Mm-hmm. Give me a call. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do you do? You just don't, it's not cross-training and have them learn to read code and write code.
Right.
It's a very complicated thing, and around the world.
Right.
And our Native Americans are the ones that are most similar to, I mean, the suicide rates in mm-hmm. India among farmers. Because like I've said on the show before, they can't just go get a job at another farm. It's not how it works.
Exactly.
At all.
Exactly.
If the farm disappears because there's drought, the other farms are disappearing as well. So it's really a very sad picture to look at.
And it's
ponder.
A health problem as well. Studies have been done that if Indigenous people are not eating their traditional foods, which their bodies are designed to maximize the use of, then they suffer all sorts of health problems. Native Americans have the highest rate of diabetes of any group in the United States, and a chunk of that is because they're not eating the traditional foods that they ate for many, many years. So,
and it's so funny you bring that up, because I'm reading the very, very exciting How Not to Die diet book.
Oh, good.
And yeah, it was very, another uplifting thing that I chose to do, but we are working in our family hard to change our diets. And what you said holds so true, because there are things that are healthy for us, depending upon any number of factors. And all we have to do is look at our healthcare system to see how that's working.
Oh, yes.
We're not pretty much eating a lot of the things we're supposed to be, and are we ever paying for it? It shocked me, the research this doctor did, relating it even to mental health issues, an improper diet. It blew me away, and brain cancer, and prostate cancer, and heart disease. But breast cancer, I mean, diet-related, and he knew what he was doing because he spent 10 years researching.
Oh, wow.
So he's got it. So I'm good. I'm changing. I had oatmeal for breakfast instead of bacon and eggs.
Good for you.
There's going to be a lot more oatmeal in my future.
Excellent.
So continue on if you have more to share about them. But what I'm wondering is, and if you do, yes, what I think you've done is demonstrate the complexity of these issues, how a complex problem with many, many things to be looked at. But then what do you feel is your contribution? I know what I think. To me, you're raising awareness, and hopefully we can get to a call to action. But what has been your personal involvement, and what would you like to keep doing to bring these issues to the surface?
I think one of the most dramatic things that human beings can do to help other human beings is listen to their stories, respect what they're saying, and share those stories with people who may not know about them. And that's what I'm trying to do. The stories of what these people are going through, to me, is very dramatic.
Very tragic.
The resilience that they bring, though, their love of their communities, their love of their neighbors and family members, inspires me. And for something that is going on and has been going on for a while, but goes on in quiet corners of this country where people don't know about it unless they bump into a story randomly, often, for the most part. I think the best thing we can do is let people know that this is not some abstract thing that doesn't relate to human beings that are just trying to live their lives like all of us are. And learning, listening, and sharing those stories, I think, is the best that I can do. I'm sorry it's so limited, but
it's
what I can do.
The power of storytelling is talked about on this show so much, and there's nothing more compelling. And you told stories. Mm-hmm. If you know, it got to me. I know it got to quite a few other people in our Rotary Club. And then they tell someone who tells someone, and then you end up on Mrs. Green's World on Impact
Look
Earth. Yeah, be careful what you say, because I'm listening. I'm really listening.
Her ears are tuned.
And I just, Kelly and I and another team member, Corinne, went to Bioneers in San Rafael. They say it's San Rafael, but I say San Rafael. It's okay. And a lot of the content, there's always a blessing and an acknowledgement that we are on sacred land there. And it's a remembering that is so respectful because, let's face it, we really did come and take over. And that's a scar. And I know there are people that are trying to right that and change that. But, you know, don't get me to get excited about Columbus Day. In fact, did not discover America, people. It may be a newsflash for you, but we need to change the history book.
And
America
that's starting,
was already here.
That's starting.
That's starting.
Yeah.
People are aware of it. And
I
learned the shocking reality of not even thinking about it. To me, it's like a holiday. And this young woman, 16 years old, said in first grade she would not in any way, shape, or form acknowledge Columbus Day.
Right.
And said, my grandparents have been here for, you know, 30 generations or something. My ancestors have been here, and I was here in Columbus, did not discover America. So I learned it from a young person. It's like, oh, wow, why do we still have that?
Right.
We could find a better day
and
to celebrate.
And slowly that's happening. The Indigenous Peoples Day is taking over for Columbus Day.
Which would be much more authentic and real. And
instead,
thank you for your land that I don't want to get caustic and sarcastic. but what else do you want to share with us?
Sometimes that's a challenge,
Mary
too.
Gus? Yes. It is a challenge.
Yes. Yeah. When I spoke at Rotary, I talked a little bit in general terms about the history of the federal government relationship with the tribes in this country. And that was to set a little bit of the context, too. And I don't think I want to go into it in detail here. I just want to say that over the years since Europeans came to this country, that's been a very complicated, shifting, and uncertain thing as well. And the federal policy has gone from one end of the spectrum, which is total assimilation of tribes and tribal people into the white mainstream culture, to sovereignty and self-sufficiency, which is letting the tribes make decisions for themselves that affect them. And acknowledging that tribal governments are separate sovereigns and have the right to govern what happens with their members. So right now we're in a period where the greater self-sufficiency and sovereignty is the goal. And there are a number of tribes that are doing the functions that the federal government used to do by receiving funds to funnel those programs through tribal committees or councils or whatever. And I think that the more that can be maximized, the better. I think that as time goes by, everyone acknowledges and understands that nobody gets it better than the tribe with respect to what works for them, what works for the land they're living on, what works for the resources that they're trying to protect. So there are some tribes that have like co-wildlife management agreements with the federal government, that sort of thing. Not necessarily in the exact context of what I'm talking about today, but I think that that's also a positive thing and something that needs to continue to a much greater extent. And I always feel like I have to say this, that the president who actually got this and the need for this was Nixon.
I know.
He did.
And
he did.
I think
one
you
good
should
thing.
Do. I think we should acknowledge that.
Yeah,
I really think that's important. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that it would be disingenuous of me to not acknowledge that there are major problems within a lot of the tribes. And I've learned that from tribal people about women missing, about the substance abuse issues. To do the blame game serves no purpose. To me, you come at it from a place of how do we help in partnership to make things better, stronger, safer, all of those things. But a lot of times, I mean, the politics in the tribes, I mean, people have from tribal members have told me. It's very political. I mean, they're human beings just like we are.
Anytime like you get human beings involved, there's power struggles. For foul up. Yeah,
there really is. Yeah. So I just, and I think the takeaway for me is what you said. What can we do? Learn the stories, watch some of the videos, keep it top of mind, bring it up in conversation.
Right.
And then if an opportunity comes to call your legislator or become a part of the solution, that's the best that we can do, and try to find ways to help that will, you know, bring it forward. I mean, it's happening, it's going to accelerate, and we all know that.
Right.
We all know that. I talked to my friend this morning in Michigan, and she's got about 20 inches of snow. Mm-hmm. And for her, it's like, what does the next winter look like? Because she knows it's going to be more severe and she needs to get a generator. So these changes are happening to everybody, and those islands are disappearing.
Right.
So I have my last words, unless you have anything else you think we should cover.
I just want to say a couple of things to build on what you just said. I think that knowledge is incredibly powerful. So I think getting information out to people that gives them the knowledge from which to make intelligent decisions is great.
Great.
I think words have incredible power. So teaching people how to speak about the things that are going on, listening to the words that they say about what's going on, I think is incredibly important. And I think not just with this narrow issue that I've spoken about, but issues that are related to it, that are related to climate change, that are related to global warming. The thing that, the mantra that I say to myself every day is do what you can where you can and don't give up.
Right, right. What a word of hope to end on. I mean, and like when you and I, when you got here, I said, you know, Mary, some days I just want to pull the plug and go read all those books I wanted to read and live in my little Airstream in New Mexico and withdraw. And that's not in me. It's not in you. It would last for a little bit. I mean, I think
I
could last a couple of weeks.
You need to do some of that recharging.
And then back in the advocacy stage. And things like this just ignite my passion and make me want to be a part of the solution. So here's some pretty deep thoughts and heavy words from my heart about this, because obviously what Mary's doing, what she's talking about, and my consciousness in general is very troubled by this reality. I probably shouldn't admit this on the airways, but for the first time in my life, I am really struggling with saying the last part of the Pledge of Allegiance, the liberty and justice for all part, because if we're all honest, not only is that not true, it has never been. We have never lived in a democracy in its purest sense of the word, and that really bothers me. I don't want to say that, but I believe that it's the truth spoken into word. And Mary Guss not only knows that, she's working to live in a country where we can say those words with honesty and integrity. She gets it, what it means that the land means to the Native Americans is pretty much not the same that it means to us who move in and out and made ourselves at home here in the first place, someone else's home. Mary knows that the people we talked about are the first climate refugees. The irony and the tragedy of that reality does not escape me. They were here first, and now they're the first climate refugees. What keeps me going after doing an interview like this is knowing that there are other Mary Gusses out there, that there are good people working tirelessly, passionately, and effectively in some cases to right the wrongs, to emphasize that the time is of the essence when it comes to drop dead dates for people whose land is literally disappearing before our eyes. Mary Guss, thanks for showing up here today, for fighting the good fight, for working to make America what it could be, the land of the free for all of its inhabitants. We need you. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in and for showing up, because I need you. You inspire me and encourage me to continue the good work of Mrs. Green's World in every way and truly working to impact the earth. So Mary, thanks a lot for your time and for your energy and for showing up.
My pleasure. Thank you, Gina.